Chapter 5. When Cyverdon woke, she was fidgety and irritable. She asked me twice who I was, and complained three times that my answer, which was a lie in any event, conveyed no meaningful information to her. "I don't know anyone named Breck. I've never seen you before in my life. Where am I?"
"Nowhere with a name."
"You're on Nilt." She drew a blanket around her bare shoulders, and then sulkily shoved it off again and folded her arms across her chest. "I've never even heard of Nilt. How did I end up here?"
"I have no idea." I set the food I was holding down on the floor in front of her. She reached for the blanket again.
"I don't want that."
I gestured my indifference. I had eaten and rested while she slept.
"Does this happen to you often?"
"What?"
"Waking up and finding you don't know where you are, who you're with, or how you got there." She fidgeted the blanket on and off again, and rubbed her arms and wrists together.
"A couple of times."
"I'm Breck, from the Garantate." I had already told her, but I knew she would ask me again. "I found you 2 days ago in front of a tavern. I don't know how you got there. You would have died if I'd left you. I'm sorry if that's what you wanted." For some reason that angered her.
"How very charming you are, Breck, from the Garantate."
She sneered slightly as she said it. It was mildly, irrationally surprising to hear that tone from her, naked and dishevelled as she was, and not in uniform. That tone made me angry. I knew very precisely why I was angry, and I knew as well that if I dared to explain my anger to Cyverdon, she would respond with nothing but contempt, and that made me even angrier. I held my face in the neutral, slightly interested expression I had used with her from the moment she'd awakened, and made the same indifferent gesture I had made moments before. I had been the first ship Cyverdon ever served on. She'd arrived fresh out of training, 17 years old, plunged straight into the tail end of an annexation. In a tunnel carved through red-brown stone under the surface of a small moon, she had been ordered to guard a line of prisoners, 19 of them, crouched naked and shivering along the chill passageway, waiting to be evaluated. Actually, I was doing the guarding. 7 of me, ranged along the corridor, weapons ready. Cyverdon, so young then, still slight, dark hair, brown skin and brown eyes, unremarkable, unlike the aristocratic lines of her face, including a nose she hadn't quite grown into yet. Nervous, yes, left in charge here just days after arriving, but also proud of herself and her sudden small authority. Proud of that dark brown uniform jacket, trousers and gloves, that lieutenant's insignia. And, I thought, a tiny bit too excited at holding an actual gun in what certainly wasn't a training exercise. One of the people along the wall, broad-shouldered, muscled, cradling a broken arm against her torso, wept noisily, moaning each exhale, gasping every inhale. She knew, everyone in this line knew, that they would either be stored for future use as ancillaries, like the ancillaries of mine that stood before them even now, identities gone, bodies appendages to a Rajcha'i warship, or else they would be disposed of. Cyverdon, pacing importantly up and down the line, grew more irritated with this piteous captive's every convulsive breath, until finally she halted in front of her.
"Artress tit, stop that noise!"
Small movements of Cyverdon's arm muscles told me she was about to raise her weapon. No one would have cared if she'd taken the butt of her gun and beaten the prisoner senseless. No one would have cared if she'd shot the prisoner in the head, so long as no vital equipment was damaged in the process. Human bodies to make into ancillaries weren't exactly a scarce resource. I stepped in front of her. "Lieutenant," I said, flat and toneless, "the tea you asked for is ready." Actually, it had been ready 5 minutes before, but I'd said nothing, held it in reserve. In the readings coming from that terribly young Lieutenant Cyverdon, I saw startlement, frustration, anger.
irritation.
That was 15 minutes ago, she snapped.
I didn't answer. Behind me, the prisoner still sobbed and moaned.
Can't you shut her up?
I'll do my best, Lieutenant, I said, though I knew there was only one way to really do that, only one thing that would silence that captive's grief. The newly minted Lieutenant Syverdon seemed unaware of that. 21 years after arriving on Justice of Torren, just over 1,000 years before I found her in the snow, Syverdon was senior-esque lieutenant. 38, still quite young by Radcha'i standards. A citizen could live some 200 years. Her last day, she sat drinking tea on her bunk in her quarters, 3 meters by 2 meters by 2, white-walled, severely neat. She was grown into that aristocratic nose by now, grown into herself, no longer awkward or unsure. Beside her on the tightly made-up bunk sat the Esk Decade's most junior lieutenant, arrived just weeks ago, a sort of cousin of Syverdon's, though from another house, taller than Syverdon had been at that age, broader, a bit more graceful, mostly. Nervous at being asked to confer in private here with a senior lieutenant, cousin or no, but concealing it. Syverdon said to her,
You want to be careful, Lieutenant, who you favour with your attentions.
The very young lieutenant frowned, embarrassed, realising suddenly what this was about.
You know who I mean, continued Syverdon,
and I knew too. One of the other Esk lieutenants had definitely noticed when the very young lieutenant had come on board, had been slowly, discreetly, sounding out the possibility of the very young lieutenant perhaps noticing her back. But not so discreetly that Syverdon hadn't seen it. In fact, the entire decade room had seen it, and seen as well the very young lieutenant's intrigued response.
I know who you mean, said the very young lieutenant, indignant, but I don't see why.
Ah, said Syverdon, sharp and peremptory. You think it's harmless fun. Well, it would probably be fun.
Syverdon had slept with the lieutenant in question herself at one point, and knew whereof she spoke.
But it wouldn't be harmless. She's a good enough officer, but her house is very provincial. If she weren't senior to you, there would be no problem.
The very young lieutenant's house was definitely not very provincial. Naive as she was, she knew immediately what Syverdon meant, and was angry enough at it to address Syverdon in a way that was less formal than propriety demanded.
Artra's tits, cousin! No one said anything about clientage. No one could. None of us can make contracts until we retire.
Among the wealthy, clientage was a very hierarchical relationship. A patron promised certain sorts of assistance to her client, both financial and social, and a client provided support and services to her patron. These were promises that could last generations. In the oldest, most prestigious houses, the servants were nearly all the descendants of clients, for instance, and many businesses owned by wealthy houses were staffed by client branches of lower ones.
These provincial houses are ambitious, Syverdon explained,
voice the slightest bit condescending.
And clever as well, or they wouldn't have gotten as far as they have. She's senior to you, and you've both got years to serve yet. Grant her intimacy on those terms, let it continue, and depend on it one of these days she'll be offering you clientage when it ought to be the other way around. I don't think your mother would thank you for exposing your house to that sort of insult.
The very young lieutenant's face heated with anger and chagrin. The shine of her first adult romance suddenly gone. The whole thing turned sordid and calculating. Syverdon leaned forward, reached out for the tea flask, and stopped, with a surge of irritation, said silently to me, the fingers of her free hand twitching,
This cuff has been torn for 3 days.
I said, directly into her ear, I'm sorry, Lieutenant.
I ought to have offered to make the repair immediately,
dispatched a segment of one esque to take the offending shirt away. I ought, in fact, to have mended it 3 days before, ought not to have dressed her in that shirt that day. Silence in the cramped compartment. The very young lieutenant still preoccupied with her discomfiture. Then I said, directly into Syverdon's ear, "Lieutenant, the decade commander will see you at your earliest convenience." I had known the promotion was coming, had taken a petty satisfaction in the fact that even if she ordered me that moment to mend her sleeve, I would have no time to do it. As soon as she left her quarters, I started packing her things, and 3 hours later she was on her way to her new command, freshly made captain of Sword of Nathtas. I hadn't been particularly sorry to see her go. Such small things. It wasn't Syverdon's fault if she had reacted badly in a situation that few, if any, 17-year-olds could have handled with aplomb. It was hardly surprising that she was precisely as snobby as she had been brought up to be. Not her fault that over my, at the time, 1,000 years of existence, I had come to have a higher opinion of ability than of breeding, and had seen more than one very provincial house rise far enough to lose that label and turn out its own versions of Syverdon. All the years between young Lieutenant Syverdon and Captain Syverdon, they were made up of tiny moments, minor things. I never hated Syverdon. I had just never particularly liked her. But I couldn't see her now without thinking of someone else. The next week at Strigan's house was unpleasant. Syverdon needed constant looking after and frequent cleaning up. She ate very little, which in some respects was fortunate, and I had to work to make sure she didn't get dehydrated. But by the end of the week she was keeping her food down and sleeping at least intermittently. Even so, she slept lightly, twitching and turning, often trembling, breathing hard and waking suddenly. When she was awake and not weeping, she complained that everything was too harsh, too rough, too loud, too bright. Another few days after that, when she thought I was asleep, she went to the outer door and stared out over the snow, and then put on her clothes and a coat and trudged to the outbuilding, and then the flyer. She tried to start it, but I had removed an essential part and kept it close. When she returned to the house, she had at least the presence of mind to close both doors before she tracked snow into the main room, where I sat on a bench, holding Strigan's stringed instrument. She stared, unable to conceal her surprise, still shrugging slightly, uncomfortable in the heavy coat, itchy.
"I want to leave," she said,
in a voice oddly half-cowed and half-arrogant, commanding Rajcha'i. "We'll leave when I'm ready," I said, and fingered a few notes on the instrument. Her feelings were too raw for her to be able to conceal them just now, and her anger and despair showed plainly on her face. "You are where you are," I said, in an even tone, "as a result of decisions you made yourself." Her spine straightened. Her shoulders went back.
"You don't know anything about me, or what decisions I have or haven't made."
It was enough to make me angry again. I knew something about making decisions and not making them.
"Ah, I forget. Everything happens as Amaat wills. Nothing is your fault."
Her eyes went wide. She opened her mouth to speak, drew breath, but then blew it out sharp and shaky. She turned her back ostensibly to remove her outer coat and drop it on a nearby bench.
"You don't understand," she said,
contemptuous, but her voice trembled with suppressed tears.
"You're not Rajcha'i."
"Not civilized."
"Did you start taking Kef before or after you left the Raj?"
It shouldn't have been available in Rajcha'i territory, but there was always some minor smuggling station authorities might turn a blind eye toward. She slumped down onto the bench beside where she'd sloppily left her coat.
"I want
tea. There's no tea here. I set the instrument aside. There's milk. More specifically, there was fermented bove milk, which the people here thinned with water and drank warm. The smell, and taste, was reminiscent of sweaty boots, and too much of it would likely make Syverdon slightly sick.
What sort of place doesn't have tea?
She demanded, but leaned forward, elbows on her knees, and put her forehead on her wrists, her bare hands palm up, fingers outstretched. This sort of place, I answered. Why were you taking Kef?
You wouldn't understand.
Tears dropped into her lap. Try me. I picked up the instrument again, picked out a tune. After 6 seconds of silent weeping, Syverdon said,
She said it would make everything clearer.
The Kef would? No answer. What would be clearer?
I know that song,
she said, her face still resting on her wrists. I realized it was very likely the only way she would recognize me, and changed to a different tune. In one region of Valskai, singing was a refined pastime, local choral associations the center of social activity. That annexation had brought me a great deal of the sort of music I had liked best, when I had had more than one voice. I chose one of those. Syverdon wouldn't know it. Valskai had been both before and after her time.
She said,
Syverdon said finally, lifting her face from her hands,
that emotions clouded perception, that the clearer sight was pure reason, undistorted by feeling.
That's not true. I'd had a week with this instrument, and very little else to do. I managed 2 lines at once.
It seemed true, at first. It was wonderful at first. It all went away. But then it would wear off, and things would be the same, only worse, and then after a while it was like not feeling, felt bad, I don't know. I can't describe it. But if I took more, that went away.
And coming down got less and less endurable. I'd heard the story a few times in the past 20 years.
Oh, Ahmad's grace,
she moaned.
I want to die.
Why don't you? I changed to another song. My heart is a fish hiding in the water grass, in the green. She looked at me as though I were a rock that had just spoken. You lost your ship, I said. You were frozen for 1,000 years. You wake up to find the Ratch has changed. No more invasions, a humiliating treaty with the Preska. Your house has lost financial and social status. No one knows you or remembers you or cares whether you live or die. It's not what you were used to, not what you were expecting out of your life, is it? It took 3 puzzled seconds for the fact to dawn.
You know who I am.
Of course I know who you are. You told me. I lied. She blinked, tearily, trying, I supposed, to remember if she had or not. But her memories were, of course, incomplete. Go to sleep, I said, and laid my fingers across the strings, silencing them.
I want to leave,
she protested, not moving, still slumped on the bench, elbows on her knees.
Why can't I leave?
I have business here, I told her. She curled her lip and scoffed. She was right, of course. Waiting here was foolish. After so many years, so much planning and effort, I had failed. Still. Go back to bed. Bed was the pallet of cushions and blankets beside the bench where she sat. She looked at me, half sneering still and contemptuous, and slid down to the floor and lay, pulled a blanket over herself. She wouldn't sleep at first, I was sure. She would be trying to think of some way to leave, to overpower me or convince me to do what she wanted. Any such planning would be useless, until she knew what she wanted, of course. But I didn't say that. Within the hour, her muscles slackened, and her breathing slowed. Had she still been my lieutenant, I would have known for certain she slept, known what stage of sleep she was in, known whether or not she dreamed. Now, I could only see externals. Still wary, I sat on the floor, leaning against another bench, and pulled a blanket up over my legs. As I had done every time I'd slept here, I opened my inner coat and put my hand on my gun, leaned back, and closed my eyes. 2 hours later, a faint sound woke me. I lay unmoving, my hand still on my gun. The faint sound repeated itself, slightly louder. The second door closing. I opened my eyes, just the slightest bit. Syverdon lay too quiet on her pallet. Surely she had heard the sound as well. Through my eyelashes, I saw a person in outdoor clothes. Just under 2 meters tall, thin under the bulk of the double coat, skin iron grey. When she pushed back her hood, I saw her hair was the same. She was certainly not a Nilta. She stood, watching me in Syverdon for 7 seconds, and then quietly stepped to where I lay, and bent to pull my pack toward her with one hand. In the other she held a gun, pointed steadily at me, though she seemed not to know I was awake. The lock baffled her for a few moments, and then she pulled a tool out of her pocket which she used to bypass the lock quite a bit more quickly than I had anticipated. Her gun still trained on me, and glancing occasionally at still motionless Syverdon, she emptied the pack. Spare clothes. Ammunition but no gun, so she would know or suspect that I was armed. 3 foil-wrapped packets of concentrated rations, eating utensils and a bottle for water. A gold disc, 5 centimeters in diameter, 1.5 centimeters thick, that she puzzled over, frowning, and then set aside. A box, which she opened to find money. She let out an astonished breath when she realized how much, and looked over at me. I didn't move. I don't know what she had thought she would find, but she seemed not to have found it, whatever it was. She picked up the disc that had puzzled her, and sat on a bench from which she had a clear view of both me and Syverdon. Turning the disc over, she found the trigger. The sides fell away, opening like a flower, and the mechanism disgorged the icon. A person nearly naked except for short trousers and tiny jewel and enamel flowers. The image smiled, serene. She had 4 arms. One hand held a ball, the other arm was encased in a cylindrical arm guard. Her other hands held a knife and a severed head, which dripped jeweled blood at her bare feet. The head smiled the same smile of saintly utter calm, as she did. Strigan. It had to be Strigan, frowned. The icon had been unexpected. It had piqued her curiosity yet further. I opened my eyes. She tightened her grip on her gun, the gun I was now looking at as closely as I could. Now my eyes were fully open. Now I could turn my head toward it. Strigan held the icon out, raised a steel-grey eyebrow. Relative? She asked, in rapture eye. I kept my face pleasantly neutral. Not exactly, I said, in her own language. I thought I knew what you were when you came, she said, after a long silence, thankfully following my language switch. I thought I knew what you were doing here. Now I'm not so sure. She glanced at Syverdon, to all appearances completely undisturbed by our talking. I think I know who he is. But who are you? What are you? Don't tell me Breck from the Garantate. You are as rat-to-eye as that one. She gestured slightly towards Syverdon with her elbow. I came here to buy something, I said, determined to keep from staring at the gun she held. He's incidental. Since we weren't speaking Radchai, I had to take gender into account. Strigan's language required it. The society she lived in professed at the same time to believe gender was insignificant. Males and females dressed, spoke, acted indistinguishably. And yet no one I'd met had ever hesitated or guessed wrong. And they had invariably been offended when I did hesitate or guess wrong. I hadn't learned the trick of it. I'd been in Strigan's own apartment, seen her belongings, and still wasn't sure what forms to use with her now.
Incidental? Asked Strigan, disbelieving.
I couldn't blame her. I wouldn't have believed it myself except I knew it to be true. Strigan said nothing else, likely realizing that to say much more would be extremely foolish if I was what she feared I was. Coincidence, I said, glad on at least one count that we weren't speaking Radchai, where the word implied significance. I found him unconscious. If I'd left him where he was, he'd have died. Strigan didn't believe that either from the look she gave me. Why are you here? She laughed, short and bitter, whether because I'd chosen the wrong gender for the pronoun or something else, I wasn't certain.
I think that's my question to ask.
She hadn't corrected my grammar, at least. I came to talk to you. To buy something. Syverdin was ill. You weren't here. I'll pay you for what we've eaten, of course. She seemed to find that amusing for some reason.
Why are you here?
She asked. I'm alone, I said, answering her unspoken question. Except for him. I nodded at Syverdin. My hand was still on my gun, and Strigan likely knew why I kept that hand so still under my coat. Syverdin still feigned sleep. Strigan shook her head slightly, disbelieving.
I'd have sworn you were a corps soldier.
An ancillary, she meant.
When you arrived, I was certain of it.
She'd been hiding nearby then, waiting for us to leave, and the entire place had been under her surveillance. She must have trusted her hiding place quite extravagantly. If I had been what she feared, staying anywhere near would have been extremely foolish. I would certainly have found her.
But when you saw there was no one here, you wept. And him?
She shrugged toward Syverdin, slack and motionless on the pallet. Sit up, citizen, I said to Syverdin in Radchai. You're not fooling anyone.
Fuck off,
she answered, and pulled a blanket over her head, then shoved it off again and rose slightly shaky and went into the sanitary facility and closed the door. I turned back to Strigan. That business with the flyer rental. Was that you? She shrugged ruefully. He told me a couple of Radchai were coming out this way. Either he badly underestimated you, or you're even more dangerous than I thought.
Which could be considerably dangerous.
I'm used to being underestimated. And you didn't tell her, him, why you thought I was coming. Her gun hadn't wavered.
Why are you here?
You know why I'm here. A quick change in her expression instantly suppressed. I continued, not to kill you. Killing you would defeat the purpose. She raised an eyebrow, tilted her head slightly.
Would it?
The fencing, the fainting, frustrated me. I want the gun.
What gun?
Strigan would never be so foolish as to admit the thing existed, that she knew what gun I was talking about. But her pretended ignorance didn't convince. She knew. If she had what I thought she had, what I had gambled my life she had, further specificity would be unnecessary. She knew. Whether she would give it to me was another question.
I'll pay you for it. I don't know what you're talking about.
The Garsadai did everything in fives. Five right actions, five principal sins, five zones, times, five regions, 25 representatives to surrender to the Lord of the Ratch. For 3 seconds, Strigan was utterly still. Even her breathing seemed to have stopped. Then she spoke.
Garset, is it?
What does that have to do with me? I'd never have guessed if you'd stayed where you were.
Gar said it was 1,000 years ago and very, very far away from here.
25 representatives to surrender to the Lord of the Ratch, I repeated, and 24 guns recovered or otherwise accounted for. She blinked, drew in a breath.
Who are you?
Someone ran. Someone fled the system before the Ratch Eye arrived. Maybe she was afraid the guns wouldn't work as advertised. Maybe she knew that even if they did, it wouldn't help.
On the contrary, no. Wasn't that the point? No one defies Anaanda Nyanai.
She spoke bitterly.
Not if they want to live.
I said nothing. Strigan's hold on the gun didn't waver. Even so, she was in danger from me if I decided to harm her, and I thought she suspected that.
I don't know why you think I have this gun you're talking about. Why would I have it?
You collected antiques, curiosities.
You already had a small collection of Ghar Sedai artifacts. They'd made their way to Dras Anya Station somehow. Others might do so as well.
And then one day, you disappeared.
You took care you wouldn't be followed. That's a very slight basis for such a large assumption.
So, why this?
I gestured carefully with my free hand, the other still under my coat holding my gun. You had a comfortable post on Dras Anya. Patience, plenty of money, associations and reputation. Now you're in the icy middle of nowhere, giving first aid to bove herders.
A personal crisis, she said. The words carefully, deliberately pronounced.
Certainly, I agreed. You couldn't bring yourself to destroy it, or pass it on to someone who might not be wise enough to realize what a danger it presented. You knew as soon as you realized what you had that if Ratch authorities ever even dreamed of half imagining it existed, they would track you down and kill you, and anyone else who might have seen it. While the Ratch wanted everyone to remember what had happened to the Ghar Sedai, they wanted no one to know just how the Ghar Sedai had managed to do what they'd done, what no one had managed to do for 1,000 years before or another 1,000 years after. Destroy a Ratch Ch'ai ship. Almost no one alive remembered. Anaanda Mianai certainly did. And Saivadin, who had seen for herself what the Lord of the Ratch wanted no one to think was possible. That invisible armor and gun, those bullets that defeated Ratch Ch'ai armor and her ship's heat shield so effortlessly.
I want it, I told Strigan. I'll pay you for it.
If I had such a thing, if... It's entirely possible no amount of money in the world would be sufficient.
Anything is possible, I agreed.
Your Ratch Ch'ai and your military.
Was, I corrected.
And when she scoffed, I added, if I still were, I wouldn't be here. Or if I were, you would already have given me whatever information I wanted and you'd be dead. Get out of here.
Strigan's voice was quiet but vehement.
Take your stray with you.
I'm not leaving until I have what I came for. There would be little point in doing so. You'll have to give it to me. Or shoot me with it.
As much as admitting I still had armor. Implying I was precisely what she feared. A Ratch Ch'ai agent come to kill her and take the gun. Frightened of me as she must be, she could not avoid her own curiosity.
Why do you want it so badly?
I want, I told her, to kill Anaanda Mianai.
What?
The gun in her hand trembled, moved slightly aside, then steadied again. She leaned forward 3 millimeters and cocked her head as though she was certain she hadn't heard me correctly.
I want to kill Anaanda Mianai, I repeated. Anaanda Mianai,
she said bitterly.
"Has thousands of bodies in hundreds of locations. You can't possibly kill him, certainly not with one gun."
"I still want to try."
"You're insane. Or is that even possible? Aren't all Ratchai brainwashed?"
It was a common misconception. Only criminals, or people who aren't functioning well, are re-educated. Nobody really cares what you think, as long as you do what you're supposed to. She stared, dubious.
"How do you define not functioning well?"
I made an indefinite, not my problem gesture with my free hand, though perhaps it was my problem. Perhaps that question did concern me now, insofar as it might very well concern Cyverdon. "I'm going to take my hand out of my coat," I said, "and then I'm going to go to sleep." Strigan said nothing, only twitched one grey eyebrow. "If I found you, Anna and me and I certainly can," I said. We were speaking Strigan's language. What gender had she assigned to the Lord of the Ratch? "He hasn't yet, possibly, because he's currently preoccupied with other matters, and for reasons that ought to be clear to you, he is likely hesitant to delegate in this affair."
"I'm safe, then?"
She sounded more convinced of that than she could possibly be. Cyverdon came noisily out of the bathroom and sank back onto her pallet, hands trembling, breathing quick and shallow. "I'm taking my hand out of my coat now," I said, and then did that, slowly, empty. Strigan sighed and lowered her gun.
"I probably couldn't shoot you anyway."
Because she was sure I was Ratchai military, and hence armoured. Of course, if she could take me unawares, or fire before I could extend my armour, she could indeed shoot me. And of course, she had that gun, though she might not have it near to hand. "Can I have my icon back?" She frowned, and then remembered she was still holding it.
"Your icon?"
"It belongs to me," I clarified.
"That's quite a resemblance," she said, looking at it again. "Where's it from?"
"Very far away." I held out my hand. She returned it, and one-handed I brushed the trigger and the image folded into itself, and the base closed into its gold disc. Strigan looked over at Cyverdon intently and frowned.
"Your stray is having some anxiety."
"Yes." Strigan shook her head, frustrated or exasperated, and went into her infirmary. She returned, went to where Cyverdon sat, leaned over and reached for her. Cyverdon started, shoving herself up and back, grabbing Strigan's wrist in a move I knew was meant to break it. But Cyverdon wasn't what she had once been. Dissipation and what I suspected was malnutrition had taken a toll. Strigan left her arm in Cyverdon's grasp, and with her other hand plucked a small white tab out of her own fingers and stuck it to Cyverdon's forehead.
"I don't feel sorry for you," she said in Ratchai. "It's just that I'm a doctor."
Cyverdon looked at her with an unaccountable expression of horror.
"Let go of me."
"Let go, Cyverdon, and lie down," I said sharply. She stared 2 seconds more at Strigan, but then did as she was told.
"I'm not taking him as my patient,"
Strigan said to me, as Cyverdon's breathing slowed and her muscles slackened.
"It isn't more than first aid, and I don't want him panicking and breaking my things."
"I'm going to sleep now," I answered. "We can talk more in the morning."
"It is morning."
But she didn't argue further. She wouldn't be foolish enough to search my person while I slept. She would know how dangerous that would be. She wouldn't shoot me in my sleep either, though it would be a simple and effective way to be rid of me. Asleep, I would be an easy target for a bullet, unless I extended my armor now and left it up. But there was no need. Strigan wouldn't shoot me, at least not until she had the answers to her many questions. Even then she might not. I was too good a puzzle. Strigan wasn't in the main room when I woke, but the door into the bedroom was closed, and I assumed she was either asleep or wanted privacy. Syverdin was awake, staring at me, fidgeting, rubbing her arms and shoulders. A week earlier, I'd had to prevent her from scraping her skin raw. She'd improved a great deal. The box of money lay where Strigan had left it. I checked it. It was undisturbed. Put it away. Latched my pack closed, thinking the while what my next step should be. "Citizen," I said to Syverdin, brisk and authoritative. "Breakfast." "What?" She was surprised enough to stop moving for a moment. I lifted the corner of my lip just slightly. "Shall I ask the doctor to check your hearing?" The stringed instrument lay beside me, where I had set it the night before. I picked it up, plucked a fifth. "Breakfast."
"I'm not your servant," she protested, indignant.
I increased my sneer, just the smallest increment. "Then, what are you?" She froze, anger visible in her expression, and then very visibly debated with herself how best to answer me. But the question was now too difficult for her to answer easily. Her confidence in her superiority had apparently taken too severe a blow for her to deal with just now. She didn't seem to be able to find a response. I bent to the instrument and began to pick out a line of music. I expected her to sit where she was, sullen, until at the very least hunger drove her to prepare her own meal, or maybe, much delayed, find something to say to me. I found I half hoped she'd take a swing at me, so I could retaliate. But perhaps she was still under the influence of whatever Strigan had given her last night, even if only slightly. The door to Strigan's room opened, and she walked into the main living space, stopped, folded her arms, and cocked an eyebrow. Syverdin ignored her. None of us said anything, and after 5 seconds, Strigan turned and strode to the kitchen and swung open a cabinet. It was empty, which I'd known the evening before.
"You've cleaned me out, Breck, from the Garantate," Strigan said, without rancor,
almost as though she thought it was funny. We were in very little danger of starving. Even in summer here, the outdoors effectively functioned as a huge freezer, and the unheated storage building held plenty of provisions. It was only a matter of fetching some and thawing them. "Syverdin?" I spoke in the casually disdainful tone I had heard from Syverdin herself in the distant past. "Bring some food from the shed." She froze, and then blinked, startled.
"Who the hell do you think you are?"
"Language, citizen," I chided. "And I might ask you the same question."
You ignorant nobody!"
The sudden intensity of her anger had brought her close to tears again.
"You think you're better than me. You're barely even human."
She didn't mean because I was an ancillary. I was fairly sure she hadn't yet realized that. She meant because I wasn't Rajtai, and perhaps because I might have implants that were common some places outside Raj space, and that would, in Rajtai eyes, compromise my humanity.
"I wasn't bred to be your servant."
I can move very, very quickly. I was standing, and my arm halfway through its swing before I registered my intention to move. The barest fraction of a second passed during which I could have possibly checked myself, and then it was gone, and my fist connected with Syverdin's face, too quickly for her to even look surprised. She dropped, falling backward onto her pallet, blood pouring from her nose, and lay unmoving.
"Is he dead?"
asked Strigan, still standing in the kitchen, her voice mildly curious. I made an ambiguous gesture. "You're the doctor." She walked over to where Syverdin lay, unconscious and bleeding, gazed down at her.
"Not dead," she pronounced. "Though I'd like to make sure the concussion doesn't turn into anything worse."
I gestured resignation. "It is as Amaat wills," I said, and put on my coat and went outside to bring in food.